DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Steve Weidenkopf, who teaches church history at the Notre Dame Graduate School of Christendom College. He's the creator of the Epic video series and a popular author and speaker on the Crusades and other historical subjects. With Steve Weidenkopf, we go inside the pages of The Glory of the Crusades, published by Catholic Answers. Steve, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Chris. I'm very happy to be here, and thanks for having me on the show.
What a fascinating book, The Glory of the Crusades. I have to admit, I could not put it down. But I think for those who are listening, it may be a surprise that you did entitle it The Glory of the Crusades. Could you help us to understand what you meant by glory?
Sure. Yeah, there's really two understandings or two ways in which I chose that title for the book. And one was to try to help Catholics understand that the Crusades are obviously a very important part of our history in the Church. They're also a very controversial subject. Most Catholics, when they, talking to someone who may not be Catholic, may have an animist or some kind of issue with the Church, will bring up the Crusades along with the Inquisition and other historical subjects to kind of attack the Catholic. And so I wanted to help Catholics, understand that these were important events that were necessary events at the time, and that we should understand the true and authentic story of these events and not shy away from them, not be afraid, not be ashamed, not look down when somebody brings up the Crusades, but rather I'm trying to encourage Catholics to study this period of time so that they can defend the Church. That's one aspect of it. The other aspect is really, I think the word glory will kind of throw some people off and in terms of how we tend to think of that term in English as kind of a triumphalistic kind of nature. What I mean by it is really the Old Testament understanding of glory. When you look in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word most often used in the Old Testament for glory is kabod, which means something that is important or heavy with weight, so something of great importance. Mm-hmm. And that's how I see the Crusades. I see the Crusades as something that is a very, very important movement in the life of the Church. It occupied 600 years of the Church's life. And so therefore, that's how I mean glory. This is something important that we as Catholics must know and must know the authentic story of.
Boy, what an important paradigm. And I'm so glad that it's right off the bat, you want to set up our understanding of the importance of Church history, of knowing Church history. I think it was Cicero who might have said that a person who doesn't know their history is destined to remain a child forever. But in this particular case, when it comes to knowing Church history, you tell us now, be careful about who's teaching you that history.
Yes, that's exactly right. Unfortunately, in our day and age and in the English-speaking world, the vast majority of our history, of Catholic history, of Western European history, has been kind of told from a English Protestant perspective. And so we get a very nuanced and skewed, I would argue, understanding of our history. So that's why I always refer to, we need to learn our authentic history. That's what I mean by that, that we need to study the documents and use authentic resources and study the contemporary accounts and look at, historians on both sides, both, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, non-denominational, historian that has no religious faith at all either. Look at all of their work and try to come through all of that, this authentic presentation, and understand where there is bias. I mean, we know that, for example, many of the myths that people believe about the Crusades were started and began in the 16th century with Martin Luther. He was the one who first openly, publicly criticized in a serious manner the crusading movement, who wasn't Catholic. Also, that translates later on to the Enlightenment with philosophical authors who were writing, also attacking religion as a whole. And so that's where this kind of negative animus and negative attack against this anti-narrative, so to speak, against the Crusades, that's where it begins. And so as Catholics, we just need to know that and know that those who are perpetuating these myths, that's what their perspective is. And so we can understand that and then go through that and find authentic scholarship.
Well, I just want to let the listeners know as well, in The Glory of the Crusades, you present a very honest telling. I mean, you shine a very bright light and you see many things, those moments that were of great heroism and great courage, but also those moments that they were shameful moments on both sides.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the task of an authentic historian, again, is to tell the actual story without as much nuance, as you can, but present it in a way so that people can help understand the historical context. You know, we as Catholics have a rich history. We have, our history spans 2,000 years plus. It's a story of great drama. There's great, comedy also in our history. Mm-hmm. There's heroes, there's villains, there's all, and so we can never shy away from telling the authentic story. You know, as you put it aptly, shining that bright light on our history. We have to tell, both sides, the good and the bad, along with our history. And I think by doing so, then again, that helps people, who maybe have a different perspective than us, have a different faith understanding than us, that they can see that, hey, we're not just kind of whitewashing things. We're not just trying to, and I especially try not to do that in my book, that we see the authentic picture, then they'll be more apt to, I think, maybe change their perspective and see it, from a more authentic perspective, more Catholic perspective, when they realize that the Catholic historian or the Catholic who's defending the church is not just kind of towing the party line, so to speak, or just saying everything's good and there was nothing that was bad. We have to be realistic in our presentation of history.
Even the term crusade is not something that even those crusaders would have understood, because that's really a modern term, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly right. That's, if you would travel back in time to the 11th century at the calling of the first crusade and ask somebody who had a cloth cross on their garment, as a sign of those who went on the crusade, and say, oh, you're going on the crusade, they would have looked at you like you were crazy. They would have had no understanding as to what you were talking about. They didn't refer to themselves as crusaders or going on the crusade. For them, those who went on crusade were called crucis signati in Latin, or those signed the cross. And they were volunteers who set themselves apart, who took an actual vow to go on this armed pilgrimage known as a crusade, and the identifying marker of those going on crusade was that cloth cross, so that's how you would know who was going and who wasn't. What they referred to it as they called what they were doing is known as a passagia, or the journey, or the pilgrimage, primarily oriented towards Jerusalem. So crusade is a modern term, comes from the 18th century, and it's a kind of a mismatch of a bunch of English and Latin and French, and that's, it was kind of a created word, and it gained favor, in that time, in the 18th century. So it's something that they never would have understood or have used.
And there wasn't just one crusade, and really, quite honestly, and your book helped me to understand this even more, but it's actually an experience of Christendom during this period. Would I be stating that properly?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I like to refer to it as a movement. It was the crusading movement. It was something that, like I mentioned before, took place from the 11th century, all the way up through the 17th century. So it was a wide-ranging movement that occupied all aspects of Christendom. Had ecumenical councils, the large gatherings of bishops, in the church's history that meet to discuss doctrine and discipline and matters of the church. Six of the 21 in the church's history, discussed the crusades, planned a crusade or discussed an expedition to the Holy Land in some sense. A huge portion of those important events in the life of the church, again, which there haven't been that many of them in the 2,000 years. So that gives you just the one data point of the sense of how important this was. And historians traditionally number 8 crusades specifically directed against Muslims in the Holy Land or in North Africa, especially Egypt. But there are other forms of crusades as well. The movement evolved over time, obviously. Something that spans that length of time is bound to not remain stagnant. So there were various types of crusades and various forms of crusades, against heretics in what are now the Balkan states, for example, of Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, parts of Germany, Poland. There were crusades against heretics in the south of France, known as the Albigensian Crusade. And there were even crusades against enemies of the church. The Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II, for example, had a crusade preached against him because of his political dealings, negative political dealings with the Pope. In my book, though, I focus primarily on those 8 traditionally numbered crusades against Islam, because those are the expectations that most people have in mind when you mention the word crusade.
And we have to remember at the very beginning of all this that we can't look from our cultural paradigm at, back in history, but essentially we have to go back and take a look from their perspective and their political, cultural, economic, everything. The situation was so different than it is today.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the best way to understand history is to see it through the eyes of those who participated in the different events as much as possible, depending mm-hmm. upon the resources, the manuscripts, and what have you. But yeah, that's exactly right. And that's actually the beauty of the of crusade history, and what I try to present in my book is that over the last generation or so, last 40 years, there have been just a wealth of great crusade historians, you know, across the faith perspective, frankly, who have, you know, really endeavored to focus on learning about these events from the perspective of those who participated in them. So asking the questions, why did these people go? What motivated them to do this? What were they really about from their perspective, not from ours? And that's really, so in academia, for example, crusades are kind of unique as a historical event because you have, actually the Inquisition is in the same boat as this, but you have, in academia, you have historians who have really understood the movement, from those who participated in them. And so it's really overturned a lot of the previous history that had been written before, which is really basically propaganda, and it was written as, with a certain perspective in mind by each of the authors who did those books in the past. So you have this kind of change in academia, but unfortunately that change of understanding and a presentation of authentic history remains for the most part within academia. It hasn't really kind of filtered its way down into popular media. So Hollywood, whenever they make a movie about the Crusades or a TV show or a documentary, you know, more often than not, it still presents that kind of false anti-Catholic narrative. So the hope of my book, or one of the hopes of goals of my book, was to take that great scholarship and kind of bring it, you know, kind of make it more accessible to a wider and more popular audience.
We're talking with Steve Weidenkopf about his book, The Glory of the Crusades. And I just want to add just again, as a footnote, the importance as we study history, especially when there are people who are writing books about church history, to take a look actually at the author of those works and to find out where they are coming from, because history is written by those who might be perceived as winners. It may be written as people who have a particular agenda against the subject matter maybe in which they're speaking or writing about, or have a certain prejudice. So that's very important, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah, it is, exactly. Like, you know, just to give you one example, I mentioned just a minute ago about the, you know, authors in the past who have really negatively shaped the modern understanding of the Crusades, at least properly. One individual in particular is Sir Stephen Runciman, who was a English historian who wrote this in the 1950s, this multi-volume work on the Crusades, which was extremely popular. It's written in a narrative style, so it's a very easy read kind of thing, but it still remains popular today. And in that work, he was a Byzantine historian who really saw things from, you know, a kind of Eastern type of perspective, and had a great animus against Western Europe and against the church as a whole. So you have this very kind of anti-Western, anti-church perspective in Runciman's work, and unfortunately that has clouded in modern understandings and popular understandings of the Crusades today. So it is exceptionally important to know your author, every historian has a bias. Every historian brings to their work a perspective. The honest historian tells you up front what that is.
That first crusade, it's been called the Prince's Crusade.
Yeah, so the first crusade was preached, you know, by Pope Blessed Urban II at the local church council called the Council of Clermont. It was the local meeting of French bishops in France. And so Clement calls the first crusade. You know, people respond overwhelmingly to his call. There was great devotion to the Holy City, his specific of Jerusalem, his specific request of the Western warriors was to go to the Holy Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem on pilgrimage and to liberate that city from the control of Muslims. And that was the main objective of the first crusade. And so different important princes throughout Europe, gathered armies, and they traveled independently down to Constantinople. And then once they got to Constantinople, they were transported by ship across the Bosphorus into what is modern-day Turkey, or at the time was known as the Byzantine province of Anatolia. And then they gather their forces together there, and they kind of plan out their expedition down to the Holy Land. And the first stop on that expedition was to go to the city of Nicaea, an ancient Christian city, the site of the First Ecumenical Council in 325. And so they liberate that city, and then they decide to march. They have to march down through Anatolia on their way down to Jerusalem. And while they're going through Anatolia, they suffer it in the middle of summer. It's hot. They're running low on supplies. Many of the horses for the knights die. So many of them are walking now on foot. You have a lack of food. We're dying of starvation. Well, there's a big battle that takes place, the Battle of Dorylaeum, during that march as well, where it was kind of an iffy thing at some point in the battle where it looked like they might be wiped out, but They were able to rally and to win the battle. Then they finally make their way down to Antioch, which was, again, another ancient Christian city. The city of St. Peter was in Antioch for a time. The great St. Ignatius of Antioch, the early church father, was there as bishop as well. So they surround Antioch, and Antioch is a large, well-defended city, extremely difficult to get into. Again, people are deserting. People are dying of starvation. You know, their strength is decreasing as well. But at each turn, they're able to, you know, kind of some miraculous things happen. Just when you think the First Crusade is about ready to fall apart and self-destruct, there's a miraculous intervention which saves it. So you have them get into the city of Antioch, finally through some kind of negotiation with Bohemond, one of the princes on the crusade, is able to convince a Muslim convert inside the gates to open up one of the gates or let them into one of the towers of the city. And so they're able to get into the city. They liberate that. But as soon as they get into that city, the very next day, a large Muslim relief force shows up to attack them. So they had gotten into the city just barely in time. Then they march their way down after that. They march their way down to Jerusalem. They show up in Jerusalem with, again, few numbers. They start out with 60,000 warriors. By the time they get to the gates of Jerusalem, there's only 12,000. They have no wood to build siege engines to batter the walls of Jerusalem. But miraculously, while they're there, these ships come sailing into ports into Jaffa, and they bring wood and food and supplies, and so the army is replenished. And are able to actually then take the city after processing barefoot in a penitential manner around the city of Jerusalem first, then they're able to get into the city. So it varied many different stages of that whole First Crusade. Again, it was a kind of touch and go, but the Lord intervened and helped save them and in the situation they were in. And that's how they saw it. They believed that the Lord was with them, that they were God's army, and that he was protecting them and watching over them providing for them along the way.
I think we have to once again let people know what was it that they were fighting for, not just to go down and take land or to to expand the kingdom per se, but there was a very important reason for this force.
Exactly. Yeah, the crusade. You know, Pope Urban, when he called the First Crusade at the Council of Clermont, he focused on three different things. One was the fact that Jerusalem was in the hands of Islam and it should be returned to Christian control. He also focused on the Seljuk Turks. They were a group of people from the Asian steppe who were Muslim but not Arabs. They came down to the end of the 11th century and began to encroach upon Imperial Byzantine territory, Christian territory, and they began to harass significantly native Christians in those areas that they conquered. They also harassed and killed Christian pilgrims who were coming from Europe. So there was a real definitive threat at the time when the First Crusade was called to Christians in that area. And so the Crusades were launched not as a land grab or not as some kind of colonial enterprise, as many modern myths present them, but rather they were defensive just wars to recover lost and stolen territory and property and to defend those Christians who were living in these Muslim-occupied areas.
When we have the experience of the Second Crusade,
from 1147 to 1149, so it was about 40, 50 years or so after the First Crusade, and that one was called specifically because during the course of the First Crusade, you had some Christians that kind of broke off, some warriors broke off from the main army, and they founded a Crusader state or kind of a territory around the city of Edessa. Had been attacked by a Muslim ruler by the name of Zengi. He had come in and taken over Edessa, and when news of that got back to Christendom, the Pope again, this is Blessed Eugenius III, calls the Second Crusade to go and to recover, again, that lost territory. So the King of France, Louis VII, as well as the Holy Roman Emperor Conrad III, respond to the preaching of St. Bernard of Clairvaux, who was asked specifically by the Pope to go and preach the crusade throughout Europe. They respond, gather armies, go over to the Holy Land. Unfortunately, their crusade did not meet with as much success as the First Crusade. In fact, the Second Crusade was an abject disaster. When they got over to the Holy Land, there was a lot of issues with the Byzantines in terms of providing supplies and support. Louis's army is attacked, and he loses a good number of his troops. Conrad's army also is decimated on his march through Anatolia. By this point, the Muslims had they knew the Christians were in the area. They knew that follow-on armies were coming, and they were a little bit more prepared than they were for the First Crusade. And so ultimately, Louis and Conrad decided to take their army to the rest of their armies to Damascus, where they tried to besiege the city. They do so for a brief period of time, an abject failure. They have to leave the city and they come back as a failure, really, and dejected. And it really, really, it shaped the crusading movement, this failure, because people back in Europe had expected that every crusade would be successful because the first crusade was such an overwhelmingly kind of miraculous success. It was very disappointing, the failure of the second crusade. And so there wouldn't be another crusade called, you know, for another generation as a result of that.
We're talking with Steve Weidenkopf about his book, The Glory of the Crusades. And that second crusade, that's when we begin to experience such incredible figures in history. And I just want people to know just the snapshot you're giving us of this particular event or this period, this movement. You flesh it out so well in the book. I mean, we encounter people, Eleanor of Aquitaine, so important because she would be the mother of kings. And also, you know, another person that you mentioned briefly, but I think is so important, St. Bernard of Clairvaux, someone who kind of became, I don't want to say a fall guy, but he, you know, in his preaching, a lot of people, because it wasn't as successful as the first, they kind of put a blame on him that he didn't deserve to have.
Yeah, that's very true. And actually, you know, Bernard himself actually was very, very disappointed in the Second Crusade and what had happened. And in a certain sense, kind of, he did, you know, kind of not, you know, blame himself in a certain sense. It was a very difficult time in his life when that results of that crusade came back. And you know, people did also kind of more, I think, inappropriately place the blame on him because he was such a prominent figure in Christendom at the time. He was, you know, a very well-known religious figure in Christendom. He was very influential. Blessed Eugenius III, the Pope, was actually a student of his, so he had a direct personal relationship with the Pope. People looked up to St. Bernard, and so when this failed, it was really a blot in a certain sense that people kind of inappropriately placed on him. It wasn't his fault that the Second Crusade failed. You know, it was a combination of poor military decisions, bad logistics, and other issues that really forced the Second Crusade into disaster. So it had nothing really to do with Bernard, but he did take it personally and took it hard. But he's a fantastic figure in the whole history of the church, and I praying through for his intercession through the writing of this book, and so I felt it apt and appropriate to identify that and acknowledge him in the book. He's a great man and a great intercessor as well.
Yes, the Crusades are those events that were undertaken. Yes, there was a call to respond to a need, and those who responded in many cases were those political leaders. And they had the opportunities to make certain choices. Some of them made some great choices, some heroic choices, and others made some choices that were not necessarily the best ones. I want to be fair in how I describe it. And in the stories that we hear, especially in the Third and Fourth Crusades, I mean, those are really very compelling, because then in the Third Crusade, we'd have the rise of Saladin, but we'd also hear the name of Richard the Lionhearted, whose mother was Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Exactly. Yeah, the Third Crusade is the one that most people kind of remember or know about or have some sense of, because it is that sometimes called a Three Kings Crusade, because you had three of the major monarchs in Europe at the time all go on the crusade. So you had Frederick Barbarossa, who was the king of the Germans, the Holy Roman Emperor. He leads a very large army to the Holy Land to try to recapture and liberate the holy city of Jerusalem. I should mention that the First Crusade was successful, liberated the city of Jerusalem. Second Crusade, Jerusalem is still in the hands of Christians, but then right before the Third Crusade, you have the fall of Jerusalem by Saladin, as you mentioned. He kind of unites the Muslim forces in the area, which had been disunited previous to that time. This is the end of the 12th century. In 1187, he goes to Jerusalem with a large united Muslim force and conquers the city and takes it back over. So the city is once again in Muslim hands. Word of that gets back to Christendom, which is in Europe, which is horrific kind of news that the Christians receive. And so the Pope again calls for a third crusade to be launched in order to recover the holy city. And so these three kings respond. So you have Frederick Barbarossa, the king of the Germans. You have Richard the Lionheart, the king of England. And then you have Philip Augustus, the king of France, who all participate in the crusade. And they're funny, interesting personalities, because Philip and Richard do not like each other at all. You know, Richard had extensive land holdings in what is modern-day France and Aquitaine, as you mentioned, from his mother. So from Eleanor, so he, you know, the two of them were always politically at odds in Europe. And so they put aside their differences slightly to be able to go on crusade. But during the course of the crusade, that tension between the two of them was very readily apparent. So much so that, you know, Philip only stays on crusade for a certain period of time. He helps with the siege of the city of Acre, which is finally brought back into Christian hands. Philip leaves. He doesn't even fulfill his crusade vow by trying to go to Jerusalem. He just leaves the crusade, takes a good portion of his army with him. People, he's resoundingly criticized when he gets back to France for doing so. That was seen as something that was just something you did not do. Mm-hmm. He said that he was sick, which he did. He and Richard were both suffering from a disease, from an illness rather, while they were in the Holy Land, and so he claimed illness, and that's why he left. But that was seen as a legitimate excuse to retreat from a battle in Europe, but it was not seen as an excuse, a legitimate excuse or a valid excuse to leave the crusade. So everybody did, and that was criticized for it. So they get to the Holy Land. Richard stays with his army. He has a series of battles with Saladin. He wins a pretty significant battle, although not decisive, the Battle of Arsuf in 1191. And so then he realizes his military position is not strong enough to take the city of Jerusalem, so he enters into a treaty with Saladin, which allows Christians access to the city, because once Saladin had taken it over earlier, he expelled all Christians and refused that entrance. So now there's access to the city, to the holy city, but you know, Richard wasn't able to completely fulfill his crusade vow. And it was something that really, you know, nagged at him for the rest of his life.
Each event really deserves a thorough telling, which you do in The Glory of the Crusades. I wish we had more time, but Steve, any final thoughts?
The only thing I would say is just that I would encourage people to learn our authentic Catholic history, to you know, study these events, especially the events that are most attacked. You know, don't just accept the kind of modern anti-Catholic narratives about these historical events, the Crusades, Inquisition, Galileo, you know, all the major topics. Instead, you know, do some research on your own. My book is one place to start, on the Crusades at least, but there are many other good books that are out there and resources. So take the time to know our faith, learn the faith, and then, you know, be proud of our history as well, where appropriate. Don't be, you know, afraid or look down or be ashamed when somebody brings up the Crusades in conversation with you, but rather take it as an opportunity to evangelize, to tell people our authentic history, and to give witness of your own personal love for Jesus and his church. And by doing so, hopefully you can bring that person just a tad closer to a deeper relationship with Jesus and the church as well.
Steve, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for your time.
With Steve Weinkopf, we've gone inside the pages of The Glory of the Crusades. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to Catholic.com, the website for its publisher, Catholic Answers Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to DiscerningHearts.com. This has been a production of DiscerningHearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, Insights from Today's Most Compelling Authors.